Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Vandal Theory, a podcast about science and research at the University of Idaho. I'm Lee Cooper, science writer and editor here at U of I, and your host for today. I'm joined by my co-host today, Kyle.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kyle Fonensteel, Media Relations Manager at U of I.
All right. How are you doing today, Kyle?
I'm good. How about you?
It's an early morning, but I've got my coffee, so I think I'm ready to go. So, today, we are going to talk about glaciers, specifically how they move, or at least what we know about how they move. And to kick us off, I do have a question again. Kyle, do you happen to know what makes up a glacier?
I mean, I imagine at its base, it's some combination of water, frozen and unfrozen. I really don't know much beyond that, though.
I think you're right on track. I mean, sure, ice, water, snow, rocks. I mean, the things scrape out entire valleys, right? Have you ever actually gotten to see one?
Now that you mention it, no. I haven't seen a glacier.
They're pretty incredible to see. I've seen them in Glacier and then in Alaska as well, and they're pretty awe-inspiring. Pictures don't quite show how large they are, and you kind of get that feeling of experience when you're looking at, like, the raging river, and you're like, oh my gosh, that's, like, really powerful. This is on a different level of, like, oh my god, that thing is crazy powerful.
I definitely have to go now. I really hadn't thought about it, but thank you. That's next on the to-do list, a little homework for the podcast.
Well, today we are going to talk with Tim Bartholomus, who is an associate professor of glaciology, and he is looking at how glaciers move. Specifically, he's looking at one very speedy glacier and then how to predict how glaciers melt. So we're going to dive right in. Kyle, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right, here we go. Tim, welcome to the Vandal Theory. How are you doing today?
Good, Lee. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. I'm terribly excited to learn about what you're researching. Can you introduce yourself for everyone?
Yeah, you bet. My name is Tim Bartholomus, and I'm an associate professor in the Department of Earth and Spatial Sciences here at UI, and I'm a glaciologist.
Excellent. So why study glaciers? What is so interesting about them?
Yeah, so my research is really focused on fast glacier change, and so the way by which glaciers change faster than typical melting or typical changes in accumulation or snowfall. And so I think it's fascinating that glaciers are actually speeding up and slowing down sort of day to day and season to season and year to year. They break apart more quickly or less quickly. And so I'm really trying to try and understand why that happens. And so what are the kind of the mechanics behind some of those changes? The reason why that's important and the reason why that's sort of exciting to a broader group than just myself is that glaciers and ice sheets, the loss of ice, is contributing 2/3 of the water that's going into the oceans and raising sea level.
Did you always want to study glaciers?
No, I didn't actually. And it's kind of a funny thing. When I first started my master's degree, or I was looking for master's programs, I explicitly didn't want to study glaciers. I thought that glaciers themselves would actually be kind of boring. I was much more interested in what their impacts would be on the landscape. And so I wanted to climb mountains and understand why mountains looked the way that they did. And I thought the ice would be, you know, like studying an ice cube left out on a kitchen counter. You know, you turn up the heat and it melts a little faster. You make it a little bit cooler and it melts a little more slowly. So I really thought
easy
that it
peasy.
Would be. Yeah, I really thought that there were no interesting questions having to do with glaciers.
Well, excellent. So let's talk about one of the glaciers that you've tackled, Turner Glacier. And you went there because it was undergoing a glacier surge. Can you describe to us what that is?
So glacier surges are a sort of abrupt increases in glacier motion. Turner Glacier, or Sitkusa, as the Yakutat Tlingit who live nearby refer to it as, is one of these surge-type glaciers. You know, just 1% of worldwide glaciers are surging glaciers. And its average sort of annual motion is sort of on the order of about a few hundred feet per year. when Turner or Sikusa really starts to surge, it's moving as fast as 100 feet per day. And so surge type glaciers, they'll be doing their kind of quiescent phase, sort of nothing's going, almost as though the glacier is broken, like it's just not working like it's supposed to. And it will do that for 5 years or 30 years, or in some cases, 100 years. And then all of its motion, all of its slipping along, all of its flow happens in the matter of just 1 or 2 years. Huh. And so we went to Sikusa or Turner Glacier specifically because this glacier surges so very frequently. It's really surging every 6 years. It's one of the fastest recurring surges. And so we wanted to figure out how this works.
So you went up there to figure out why it's surging. I assume you had an idea going into it. What were you trying to measure to figure out what's going on?
Yeah, totally. The prevailing wisdom is that all of these kind of short-term fluctuations in glacier flow speed have to do with water at the bottom of the glaciers. Even though you might go out and you visit Mount Rainier or Glacier National Park and you see these kind of white patches on the landscape and they look, you know, hard and cold and frozen, there's actually water all through them. And that water moving around at the bottom of the glaciers really affects how the glacier moves. Glacier surges, the prevailing wisdom has been that there's something about the glacier hydrology, the way that water moves through the glacier, that gets disrupted or broken. During this sort of quiescent phase, the typical thought has been, you know, water is free to drain out of the glacier and, you know, there's never any buildup or stoppage. The water never gets plugged, you know, underneath the glacier. But then during the surge, to bring a surge on, the thought has been that the mud or fine rock powder that's underneath the glacier ends up kind of plugging the flow of water. And so the water pressure kind of builds up inside the glacier and
you get a stopped up toilet.
Yeah, I love the plumbing analogies. I think plumbing analogies are perfect for surges. You get, you know, the plumbing is stuck and you need to call a plumber. And in the meantime, until the plumber arrives, this glacier is ripping along 20 times faster than usual. It's exciting that we've already got some preliminary data kind of coming in on this point.
What did you find? Is this true? Is it all about the water and how slick it is on the bottom of the glacier?
So water is still important, but it turns out that it's not important in the way that we thought it would be. And so we can actually use seismometers, so earthquake monitoring equipment, and put them out on the glacier and around the glacier. And these very sensitive instruments are picking up vibrations from any source that could be earthquakes on the other side of the world or local landslides or the glacier's activity. And so the water that's moving through and underneath glaciers actually shakes the ice and the ground around these enormous water main tunnels that are underneath the glacier. And so what those seismometers have told us that we first put out in the midst of the surge, and they're still actually, we still have these instruments out now 2 years after we put them in, but they showed that there's water even in the midst of the surge when we would have expected that the plumbing system should be plugged. We see really clear evidence of water continuing to course through and underneath this glacier. So that kind of plugged up toilet analogy is not, it's definitely not the whole story.
So more studies to be done.
Yeah, our team just was up there in coastal Alaska last month, and we've just gotten back another year's worth of data from the period after the surge. And so we're really excited to look at what are the seismometers telling us now that the glacier is certainly solidly out of a surge. And we really are excited about comparing 1 year of data in the midst of one of these glacier surges and 1 year of data when, you know, the glacier wasn't flowing very much.
Well, let's talk about another study you've done. This was a little more on the computer. You have been working on projections of ice sheet and glacier melt. First off, why do we need to know how much ice sheet and glacier melt is occurring?
Yeah, the glaciers and ice sheets, the loss from Greenland and all of the world's glaciers in aggregate are contributing like 2 centimeters, you know, most of an inch of water, of new water to the world's oceans every decade. And that's happening from glaciers and ice sheets melting a little faster than they used to. We know that this is the dominant source of sea level rise. We were interested in this study to try and better assess how well are we doing at not only understanding the sea level rise that has already happened, but also how well are we doing at projecting future sea level rise.
We know glaciologists and climate scientists use computer projections to estimate how much climate change there is, and as part of that, how much ice melt is occurring. So you wanted to test how accurate those models are. So can you tell us what you did?
Yeah, that's right. You know, climate scientists can develop computer programs, so these climate models that simulate the behavior of, you know, all of the world's climate. And so they can, you know, run those models in the past and say, okay, well, how good are these climate models doing at reproducing the observations from the last 150 years when we've got actually really quite good observations of the world's climate?
We know what actually happened.
That's right. Exactly. We can compare these computer programs against reality and say, okay, good. Let's see if we can reproduce reality. And then provided that those climate models are producing reality in a reliable way, then we can make good projections going forward. And in fact, that's what climate science and climate models are at the point where, yeah, they actually do an incredibly, like a very impressive job at reproducing things like global temperature over the last 150 years. Glaciologists follow exactly the same kind of line of reasoning to understand how glaciers and ice sheets are changing. And so you put together a set of computer codes, you simulate glacier and ice sheet change. You can validate your model by comparing it with the observations from the past and then project how these glaciers and ice sheets are going to behave in the future.
Which is what you did, at least the looking backwards part.
That's right. And that's right. And so it's these projections, actually the looking forward part, that is really at the heart of one of the major outcomes of last year's IPCC report, this major UN climate report. You know, they said, where, you know, how much are the world's oceans going to rise looking ahead? Well, we looked specifically just at the hindcast, sort of the observational record, about 40 years or so, starting in the, you know, in 1980 and going up to today, and said, well, these same ice sheet models that are making the projections, how well do they do at reproducing the observations, what we've actually seen these ice sheets do over the last 40 years. And unfortunately, what we saw is that the same models that are making the projections are underestimated how much ice has been lost from the ice sheets by about a factor of 2 on average.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's rough.
Yeah. They are not doing that well, you know, at least in Greenland and Antarctica, there's sort of even much more scatter, and the ice sheet models are telling an even more complicated story. But in Greenland, where there's at least some agreement within the models, their model ice sheets are not changing as fast as the real Greenland ice sheet is. That means that if they're underestimating the modern loss, then they might underestimate the future loss as well.
Makes sense. What was your team's recommendations for potentially improving some of these?
Well, I mean, first, we wanted to acknowledge that, like, these ice sheet models and the work that the glaciologists that are doing to make these projections is the very best that we have right now. These people are working really hard, they're really smart, and using really state-of-the-art techniques to make these projections going forward. But the folks that are doing these projections, they are limited in, you know, fundamentally a lack of physical understanding as to how glaciers and ice sheets work, even at the basic physics level, like what makes a glacier speed up. In fact, that rationale is why I'm also studying Sikusa, the surge type glacier, right? I want to understand how the glacier works. The ice sheet models, they also, you know, they don't know enough about the current state of, say, the Greenland ice sheet. If we don't know what the current state of the ice sheet is, then projections going forward might really divert from reality. But I think we have some sense as to what to do about those problems. I mean, obviously science is going to still progress and we're going to still make more fundamental work. But I think the biggest obstacle to making progress today has just been that the folks that are doing this work and that are making these projections that all of the world is interested in their answers, they've been doing this basically on a volunteer effort. They, in their individual lab groups, are also doing sort of hypothesis-driven science. They're trying to better understand how ice sheets work. But the basic work of actually making a good projection out to 2100 or beyond is actually just kind of unfunded. They're doing it in their kind of like nights and weekends. They're doing it as sort of like a side hustle.
That's hilarious and depressing all at once.
The only explanation that I can think of, and I think that this is like a reasonable justification, is that, you know, I'm saying that they're insufficiently resourced. Just 10 years ago, if you had tried to resource this group of glaciologists sufficiently, and I'm not one of them, so I'm not asking for more money myself, but if you had tried to give this group more money, they would not have necessarily known even what to do with it, because the understanding of the ice sheets was too limited to really even do a good job in the first place. The challenge now going forward is that now that we do know what to do and we do know how to make a better projections, can we get this group of glaciologists enough resources, enough computer time, enough computer programmers to actually meet this incredible like $1 trillion challenge?
Well, that's a little more positive. Let's switch to one last thing I want to talk about, which just was a fun study that you did and I think surprised both of us at the response to your studying of something called glacier mice. And first off, can you define what glacier mice are?
Yeah, so glacier mice or glacier moss balls are these little sort of like pincushion-sized things. They're green, kind of squishy. And they're mostly moss and a little bit of sediment in the middle, and they just sit on the surface of glaciers. And they oftentimes are kind of in a like a colony area. They're kind of like spaced out every 5 feet or every 10 feet or so, and there's going to be like a little colony or herd of little round green tribble-like things, if you get a Star Trek reference, just sort of sit on the ice.
You wrote a study about these. One of the things that you talked about is that they do move to a certain extent and they move as a herd together. We're not talking gargantuan distances, but a little bit. And you were trying to figure out why they move, and everybody covered this story. You got, how many interviews did you end up doing for this?
I ended up doing like 5 or 6. Yeah, some that were on NPR's Morning Edition, and then a kind of a deeper dive in another NPR podcast, one with the Canadian Broadcasting Company and one of their big sort of evening variety shows. People love this story. And I think, you know, the fun part was, you know, like you said, Lee, you know, they do move. They move like about an inch a day. And the most amazing thing is, well, one, we weren't even necessarily sure that they would move. We weren't like, this was kind of, I think this was a pioneering moss ball study to understand their motion. We were just curious. This is, you know, me and my now wife at the beginning of our grad school careers, just sort of curious about like, do they move? How do they move? What makes them move? And one of the fascinating things is that they, not only do they move, not only do they change direction as a herd, like all together, as though they were communicating, these non-sentient moss balls. Well, you know, it makes you wonder. But also, you know, we couldn't explain why they changed direction and what was responsible for this herding behavior. So I think people really just loved that mystery and loved these adorable creatures.
Yeah. Everyone I tell this story to, they're like, oh, well, it's got to be, you know, wind, or it's got to be the sun. And it's like, yeah, yeah, they tested all of that. All the basic stuff. It's none of it.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's amazing. And we actually, my co-authors and I kept a Google Doc of all of the other suggestions and feedback, totally unsolicited, that we got after these stories. And they said, oh, I read about your work in Scientific American, or I heard you on the radio. And you're like, I think I know why they move. And people were really fired up about engaging with this. And it was kind of heartwarming how excited the broader public was about
your dear little glacier mice.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, so last question. Glaciers are, I mean, they're beautiful, they're amazing, but obviously we're talking kind of the sort of depressing side of climate change. How do you deal with tackling these issues day in and day out?
Well, for one, my work is not directly focused on just tracking their demise. And I think, you know, when I go to some, you know, a big conference and I do hear a presentation from somebody whose interest is just focused in tracking their loss and their diminishment and their disappearance, that stuff is really bleak. You know, and the reason why I think that glaciers are actually so exciting, in addition to that, well, they can be bleak, but is just how dynamic they are. I mean, the fact that there are so many mysteries about how they move, how water moves through them, why you can have one glacier and its neighbor just a mile or two apart doing completely different things. And so there's all kinds of amazing fundamental scientific mysteries that make glaciers really fun to work on, in addition to, you know, their beauty. And then the other thing, you know, I think there really is every reason to be concerned about glacier change and increased wildfire smoke and increased summer temperatures. But there is an exciting, positive story that's coming out now, too, is that, and that's like, if you look at the carbon dioxide emissions from the U.S. have been dropping for the last couple of decades. We're seeing an increase in renewable energy production. In fact, it's actually cheaper to produce new power by creating a new wind turbine field or a solar panel installation than it is to install a new coal or natural gas plant. Renewable energy is getting cheaper. Carbon dioxide emissions are dropping. We know what society needs to do to get away from the carbon dioxide pollution that is leading to climate change and global warming. And we're doing it. We just need to do it faster. We need to do it a lot faster to kind of avert the worst outcomes of the future. The fact that it's possible, that there's real, we know what needs to be done and we're doing it. We just need to kind of step on the non-gas pedal a little bit harder. That's encouraging to me.
All right. Well, Tim, thank you so much for coming on the Vandal Theory today.
Yeah, you bet, Lee. Thanks for your interest. And yeah, thanks to everybody who's listening.
So, Kyle, what did you think about our glaciers?
It was incredible. I guess what I'm really shocked to hear is that we're at the point where we're still trying to answer some pretty foundational questions about glaciers, how they move, you know, how things move around them. It's just really humbling to get that check about how much we know about our world.
Yeah, I agree. I'll admit, very excited that apparently our climate models are pretty dialed in. But yeah, it was actually really strange to think that we don't understand glaciers as well as I kind of assumed. I mean, like we started at the beginning, they're ice and water and some rock and snow. Like, I feel like it shouldn't be that complicated, but it sounds like each one is so unique and each one has their own little story to tell, so it's so hard to get a, you know, overarching picture of what these things are doing that the math gets super complicated.
Yes, yes. And that reminds me of what they were saying about having entire teams dedicated to studying one glacier together, and they spend a good chunk of time together studying one glacier.
Lifetimes on some of these. Whole careers.
I mean, that's incredible. I wonder what it is about that draws you to one specific glacier to study for so long.
I don't know. I guess you're going to have to go to Glacier and say hi to a few of them.
We'll do.
And of course, The glacier mice. How amazing are they?
We couldn't stop without mentioning the glacier mice.
Well, I have to tell you a story about the glacier mice. As we talked about in the podcast, we were surprised by how much everybody seemed to kind of latch onto these guys. And I ended up sharing the story on Twitter. And the next day, the producer of Sharknado followed me. And I have no idea why. We spent the next few days trying to come up with whatever the next Sharknado was going to be, but this time, glacier mice. What were they taking over next? End of the world, glacier mice. We had a good time with that.
I would go to the movie theaters for that.
Yeah, the next great horror film. Well, thank you everyone for listening to The Vandal Theory. You can visit our website at uidaho.edu/vandaltheory to learn more about all of the research that occurs here. You can also email us at vandaltheory@uidaho.edu if you have any questions or comments. We'd love it if you'd go rate and review us. We're on most of the podcasting platforms out there, and we would love it if you'd subscribe. I'm Lee Cooper.
And I'm Kyle Fonensteel.
And thanks for listening today.